At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The Charlie Kirk murder, it is a story that is continuing to emerge with new information every single day. And we're going to discuss it here in just a moment with the retired FBI agent Jennifer Coffendaffer. But I need to say this, with the story changing literally every day, by the hour sometimes, facts, information flowing, changing. Understand that when you're consuming information about the story. Because something that someone may have reported yesterday or the day before, or what someone thought was a fact or was presented as a fact and turned out not to be a fact, a lot of people are just trying to report with the best information they have. So take a deep breath before you go and attack somebody who's just trying to do their job. Just saying that. We have had no issues here, but I've seen a lot of vitriol out there on this, where just because someone is saying something, maybe that's was reported yesterday or incorrect, or you're consuming it a few days later, doesn't mean they're out to be against you or this or that. They're just trying to report what's known at the moment in time. Okay, now that that's established, what we understand right now, no radical underground cell, no years-long plot, no militant manifesto. Instead, we're learning that the man who allegedly killed Kirk, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, made the decision in just over a week, at least according to his writings that have been presented. And in that short time, he assembled a weapon, picked his target, left a handwritten note, and confessed in a flurry of text messages, all without alerting anybody. This isn't just a criminal investigation. It's a window into how supposedly a lone wolf and this violence can take root in silence and explode before anyone sees it coming. Jennifer, there's so much here to break down. I know you've been trying to break this down as well. Let's start with this handwritten note allegedly left underneath the keyboard. What's been your reaction to this piece coming out?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, this is incredible evidence. And I say this because this is not something that could be looked at as a coerced confession from law enforcement or a confession from somebody who's been a year in maximum security a security facility in lockdown. This is something that was voluntary. And these are the best kinds of confessions. Now, having to say that, there's a few caveats here, right? The original note, that seems to be called into question, which means the FBI is going to have to do the proper paper trail with the witness who would have discarded it, Mr. Twiggs, apparently, and how exactly that was discarded. And that's going to be something that a jury is going to have to look at all the details concerning that note and see if they buy it or they don't.
And I guess that's my question, and I think a lot of people in the public have about this. We don't have the note. Apparently, it has been destroyed. Walk me through what we know right now factually about how this thing was destroyed, why it was destroyed, and then how do we know what was actually on it?
Well, we know what was on it. My understanding is from a photograph that was taken of it. And so now it's been transcribed, right? We can see it in typewritten fashion. And so
has the photograph been released to the public by chance? Do we know that?
Not that I have ever seen. Okay. Only right. This is supposedly what's happening. And I loved your caveat at the beginning. This is fast moving for me. Yeah. I don't say anything that I don't hear from the FBI, from law enforcement, from a prosecutor. That's typically my source of information. And then sometimes I will use information from a reliable mainstream media source like News Nation that I know I can trust. But as you said, things are ever changing and being disseminated parts and pieces.
Yeah, I mean, that's just how this works. And if anyone has any understanding of how any breaking story happens, and this still is very much a breaking story, at the beginning, there is a lot of information. And because someone reports something incorrectly, doesn't mean they're trying to do it to hurt someone or anything. It's sometimes we just get facts incorrect. There are people out there that, yes, do report information that's not factual on purpose. It's not everyone, and it's probably not a majority of reputable reporters either. So, yeah, take a breath, everybody. Thank you. So what we know right now is that there's this letter that there's supposedly an image of. Do we know if it was handwritten? Do we know if it was typed? What do we know about it other than this?
All we know that I've read is that it was a letter. In fact, my information comes directly from the prosecutor.
Okay.
And the prosecutor did not delineate specifically whether it was handwritten. He said a letter that was written by Robinson, as I recall. Mm-hmm. So we don't know.
And then this would be having an image, supposedly, we don't know. Maybe the answer is this, we don't know. Taken by the partner that found it and like on his phone took a picture, supposedly. Is that how we're understanding this?
That's how we're understanding it. Now, the partner, and to be very clear, they have called him the lover. I refer to him as the lover because it's very confusing, right? Is he a roommate? Sure. Is he a partner? Is he a lover? He's a lover. That is how law enforcement is, in fact, describing him. His name is Lance Twiggs. And Lance Twiggs has purportedly took a picture of it. And that's what we're dealing with right now.
And then it'll be interesting to see handwriting analysis, all of that. I mean, it obviously needs to be verified, you know, that it was him because this is coming in from a third party now or another party, not directly, you know, from him. But we'll see where that goes. I'd be very curious to see that. Do you think the FBI will release that in the near future, just with the amount of eyes on this and the amount of transparency that really feels needs to exist in this investigation?
Well, when you look at it, a lot of people, particularly in the legal circles, are really hammering on this prosecutor for everything he's already released. Mm-hmm. A lot of legal beagles do not like what he has done. They're saying, you know, they're concerned about jury pools being tainted and about information coming out and the fact he said these are facts known, right? Saying that they're already facts.
Yeah.
But they are facts in his view. I mean, some things are just factual. A, we have text messages. A, we have DNA. Or B, we have DNA. C, we have this letter. It's not like he's making this up. I believe them to be actual facts. It's how a jury will interpret those. So, Tony, essentially, I think what we have is, even with this letter, Tony, it's going to depend on how well this chain of command can be proven. And if people believe Lance Twiggs, it makes a lot of sense because we have text messages where he was told by Robinson, listen, get rid of the, you know, don't say you know anything, get rid of this letter. And so he does it. So it all kind of makes sense.
And I want to get to those text messages in just a little bit. But first I want to talk about, I mean, and Robin and me were talking about this yesterday. We were texting back and forth about it. And his mind was just kind of blown on this. I'm curious to get your perspective of just how, I guess, callous this seems to have been. That this wasn't, when we think of actor that does this sort of things, it wasn't some long thought out ideology where he was, you know, as far as we can understand yet, you know, militarized or this or that. He was pissed, it seems, and knew he had access to a weapon and decided to go take the shot. I mean, at least according to the text message exchange, that's pretty much what we understand as of right now. Is it that simple? Because I think a lot of people are expecting, and their expectations may just be wrong, that this to be something far deeper, far greater, far more ideological, far more thought out. For this kind of impact on the world and people to have it been all orchestrated by somebody basically having an opinion and not having any sort of good problem-solving skills.
Well, when you look at cases like this, and I know all of us in the FBI come from a different place. We have different experience. We have different kinds of cases that we've investigated and been a part of. For me, I'm not surprised, but let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. When you look at like a McVeigh, who decided he was going to go and blow up a federal building using very archaic, getting a truck and, getting some fertilizer. I mean, to blow something up, there's literally cookbooks online. Everybody knows this, so I'm giving you some big epiphany. And to shoot somebody again, all you need is a gun of a decent quality, like a Mauser, which was a high quality rifle, combined with a good scope. That's all you need, really, to take anyone out you want. So, unlike what people think in their minds, because they've watched way too many Mission Impossible shows, I think, these missions are not impossible. And when lone wolves, who the FBI has characterized for decades as being the number one issue in terms of terrorism, that is a problem for safety within our civilization, within the United States. It's completely understandable to me that they all emanate from individuals with wackadoodle philosophies that are angry at somebody, and then they decide to take action. It really is as simple as that. And there's historically been so many instances.
Is it because we feel psychologically safer if we think, well, there must be a lot more to something like this, and it would be easier to catch if there was much more back end to this story other than this guy seeing that Charlie Kirk was coming to his campus and deciding, I'm going to go do this, because that really seems how this played out. If all of this ends up being completely accurate, I think sometimes it is safer to in our minds to think, well, it's a bigger, greater thing that would go after something like this or someone like this. Is that what's at play? Is that why we find it hard to believe sometimes that sometimes the simplest answer really is the reality?
Well, no one likes to embrace Occam's razor. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, my mantra and the mantra of most FBI agents. It's literally Occam's razor. It's not about some Israeli forces, Mossad working over here and getting people to orchestrate, him to get on the roof and do this, and crooks to get on the roof and take a shot at the president.
Yeah.
These are kids that are angry. They have issues. They don't fit in society for various reasons. And quite frankly, they're just looking to make a huge name for themselves, to live in infamy. And I think that really is the crux of it. And for us to say, oh, this must be something greater, I think television weighs into that. I really do, Tony. People think that television is reality, and it couldn't be further from reality when it comes to investigations and cases like this.
Sometimes it's interesting because our brains aren't the greatest at deciphering reality from fantasy. That's a big thing when it comes to television. While we may, on the outside go, oh, yeah, that's a drama show, that's a reality show, sometimes our brains don't necessarily pick up that part of it. And then when it comes to the back end processing of things, we get confused. And then we have distinguished notions to go this way or that way, sometimes based on fantasy, but we're not necessarily realizing it at that moment in time. I want to talk about the text exchange, and I have it here next to me. I want to go through it for people who have not read this yet, and I want to get your reactions to it as we read through it. So this is Robinson and then the roommate, Twiggs. Robinson starts, I'm still okay, my love, but I am stuck in Orem for a little while longer yet. Shouldn't be long, but I can come home, but I got to grab my rifle still. To be honest, I had hoped to keep this secret till I died of old age. I'm sorry to involve you. The roommate says, you weren't the one who did it, right? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Robinson, I am, comma. I'm sorry, roommate. I thought they caught the person, question mark. No, they grabbed some crazy old dude, then interrogated someone in similar clothing. I had planned to grab my rifle from the drop point shortly after, but most of that side of town is locked down now. It's quiet, almost enough to get out, but these one vehicle is lingering. I'm just going to stop there for a second on this. What's your take on this letter? And I don't know, the callousness of this, the language of this. I don't know. It is he that dumb, I guess, is the question. or something is feeling weird about this.
And a lot of people have said that. A lot of people have said, listen, people who are in this age bracket would never text like this. And I really don't believe that. You can't take because you...
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it just feels weird. I don't know what feels weird. So, I mean, I don't want to insinuate that I'm saying that. I just don't know. But it just feels, this idea that... Maybe he's that stupid. I mean, maybe he is. Just, I got to go grab my rifle. I thought I'd be able to get it. I thought I would live to old age. I mean, is this just some real grandiose thinking by a really stupid 22-year-old?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, the movie that I actually do think is true to form is Pulp Fiction, for anybody who's watched it. You know, they hit a bump and he shoots the guy in the back and he says, oh my gosh, I just killed Marvin. And, you know, they're arguing over who's going to clean up the brains. The reality of law enforcement, the reality of crime, is it becomes very normal. Mm-hmm. And so you talk in this sort of callous and everyday type vernacular when you're talking about things that are horrible, like an assassination. And it catches people off guard because they're talking about, it looks like they're talking about gardening or something else. And it's that tone, like, wow, I forgot to pick up my stuff at the cleaners. Oh, I'm pretty sidetracked, but I'll get to the other side of town when I can. And you're talking about indicia of an assassination. So I get it, Tony. I get why it just seems so off.
And I think maybe that hits the tone more. Cause I mean, I did initially kind of feel like not 22-year-olds don't talk this way. They don't. But look, he was a 4.0 student. He probably spoke a little more adult than other kids his age, I would say. I know he's not a kid technically, but I'm not completely discounting that by any means. But I think that's what I'm getting, and that's the weird vibe to this is just the callousness of this whole thing. It continues with roommate, why? And then Robinson, why did I do it? Yeah, I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out. If I'm able to grab my rifle unseen, I will have left no evidence. Going to attempt to retrieve it again. Hopefully they have moved on. I haven't seen anything about them finding it. How long have you been planning this? A bit over a week, I believe. I can get close to it, but there's a squad car parked right by. I think they already swept that spot, but I don't want to chance it. And then him again, I'm wishing I had circled back and grabbed it as soon as I got my vehicle. I'm worried what my old man would do if I don't bring it back. Grandpa's rifle. I don't know if it had a serial number, but it wouldn't trace to me. I worry about prints. I had to leave it in the bushes where I changed outfits. Don't have the ability or time to bring it with. I might have to abandon it and hope they don't find prints. How the fuck will I explain losing it to my old man? Only thing I was left was the rifle wrapped in a towel. Remember how I was engraving bullets? The fucking messages are mostly a big meme. If I see notices bulge UWU on Fox News, I might have a stroke. All right, I'm going to have to leave it. That really fucking sucks. He's talking about this like it's like a, I said this to Robin and he agreed. I said it's like a, he's like talking about like it's a side mission on Grand Theft Auto, like he's playing a video game, and this is real life. It's just the casualness is I get the shocking part of this whole thing. Does that shock you, just how casual this is? We don't normally see, I guess, this level of casualness when talking about something like this, or someone who just got caught with a, you know, or is admitting to such a crime.
The reason it doesn't surprise me, Tony, is I think working gangs for all those years, working organized crime, terrible crimes people do to one another, horrible. And you know, and then they go around and talk about a murder in text messages or notes or on wires. And literally they're talking in this casual, that's the perfect word for it, in a casual discussion and vernacular. Like, again, I said, like picking up your laundry. It's so every day. But remember, when this is something that you've done and it's been in your mind for a week and a half, and he doesn't care. I mean, at the end of the day, he doesn't care about Charlie Kirk. He doesn't care about the ramifications. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, I know he was book smart. I saw the grades. Yes, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, yeah.
A lot of people who are book smart are not common sense and everybody's smart. And that's one of these guys. This is one of these guys that's stupid, you know, when it comes to everyday life, I think.
I mean, did he want to get caught? I mean, that's the other part. I mean, it's like, look, he can't just be now realizing or thinking, gee, if I'm going to do this, there might be a serial number on the family weapon. Or, I mean, they're just very elementary things here that seem to have completely evaded this man's thinking. And that's what makes it very like, huh? You're realizing this now in a text to your lover?
Well, it's clear he didn't take the same courses that, you know, BK, Brian Koberger, who murdered the Idaho students, took, right?
Maybe the lack of course. Yeah.
Because it's clear he didn't do criminology, because you're right. He's failing every aspect of 101. He doesn't understand about fingerprints. He doesn't even consider seemingly DNA. He doesn't use gloves. He doesn't cover up his face. He doesn't cover up his body. He's a hot mess, which I've said from the minute this crime went down. I said, this is the sloppiest killer. There is no way he's affiliated with Mossad or with any Tifa or any other group, because they would have made sure he went out and did the mission appropriately. This is how a school kid would do it. And he's a school kid.
But he thinks to change clothes. That's a big portion of this. And that he needs to disassemble the weapon before getting off the roof. It's like he did know some steps, but it's like, why would you do this, but not that?
Well, he took the obvious steps. Guys, as a point of getting that rifle where he needed to do it, he needed to remove the stock. So we needed the screwdriver to remove the stock, to make it smaller, to likely put the receiver and the barrel down his pant leg, from what I can tell. I tried this and I put the whole gun down my pant leg, which I could run just fine with it. I wasn't moving around like him, but maybe I was thinking if he took that receiver off, or if it was moving, you know, he's trying to... He's like moving. It made everything difficult for him to walk normally.
Yeah.
But the point is, he understands that the practicality of getting the gun from point A to point B, and then he worries, well, in case I'm seen, I'm going to change my clothes. But that, as you know, is at the minuscule level of what you need to do to cover up a crime.
I have guns. I don't do a lot with them, so I'm not super knowledgeable, but I just would think the serial number thing, leaving it out in the woods or in the grass, wherever he left it, would be obvious things too. But I hear what you're saying completely, where it's some people can be very mechanically intelligent, but then have no social intelligence. And not that this is social intelligence, but I guess it would be a form of it, of just how things work out there. Again, 22, there's plenty of, you know, talk to a lot of 22-year-olds. They're not the brightest all the time. I know I wasn't the brightest at that point either. I just wonder, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of baffled by the stupidity of what he was able to carry out and the stupidity to which he did at all levels.
You know, he had this drop point that I think was somehow going to be a savior. Ooh, if I have a drop point, then I could get my car and come back and get it. It never even occurred to him the place would be crawling with police after an event like this.
What exactly? That is just
Like, why would you not, again, what the hell? There's always the old radio adage. We used to do this stupid bit where it was stupid criminal of the week, you know, and it would always be just idiotic things that people do. And they exist to this day. We have too many stories. This seems like it's that, with far greater repercussions than the coffee shop got robbed.
Well, let's be clear. That's why the FBI and law enforcement is usually successful. It's not necessarily that we're some sort of brilliant investigators as much as it is that the criminals are such idiots and they make mistake after mistake after mistake and usually leave a really easy trail for us, especially a 22-year-old who's never had any run-ins with the law before. He literally didn't think about anything. And as you well said, he spent a week and a half planning this out. It wasn't long enough.
Do you think he's stunned that he was caught? I mean, we saw the photo that he was on, he was wearing the suicide vest. He talked about suicide ideation and things of that nature. I'm wondering if this is something where, maybe subconsciously or consciously, but he wanted to die. And he, this was his way of going out, or he thought maybe this would be his way of going out. I don't know.
So I really don't think that. I think that this is a typical, and I hate to throw the word narcissist around. I'm not going to say it clinically, but
all roads lead to it.
Yeah. He really thought he wasn't going to get caught. He's like, listen, they don't have any way to catch me. Yeah, the serial number isn't going to go back to me. I mean, like, they can't take step two and say grandfather could equal son and grandson. So he definitely, I think, just thought he would get away with it. You know, everything's going smoothly. They didn't find it yet. So to me, it's just somebody just like Luigi Mangione, just like Brian Koberger, just like Larry McVeigh, or Timothy McVeigh, sorry. They think they're going to get away with it because they're so smart.
Are you surprised at how quick he turned himself in? I mean, when it looked like people were coning in on him, his family obviously going, that looks like our kid. I can't imagine that moment. And then they sit him down and it feels like a Full House moment. Did you do this? I did this. Let's call the pastor. I mean, and I'm not trying to make light, but it was like, this is how this story ends. Like, you're, oh, I did it. I'm going to go turn myself. I was kind of surprised by that moment, too. It did kind of feel like an old sitcom where everything at the end of the story, people realize their faults and then they go do the right thing. Again, not how I would imagine something like this to happen, but none of this story is something I would think would have happened to begin with. But number two, how it's playing out and the characters involved.
Well, when you look at it, Tony, right, if you wrote a movie or a segment from a drama series and you had it play out this way, everyone in your audience would go, oh yeah, right.
That like, what is this, Full House? Yeah. You know, with a horrible, horrible plot line? I mean, that's how it feels.
Yeah, nobody would believe it, that he was stupid enough not to wear gloves. And that is what plays, I think, with people having problems accepting this.
Yeah.
But we're seeing it so up close. Cash Patel is so, you know, crystal clear on what happened in terms of his transparency for the agency now, law enforcement, this prosecutor laying out his whole case. Now, we are going to see it in the preliminary hearing coming up. Mm-hmm. So it's giving us a flash of what we're going to see anyway, because there will be no indictment. There will be no grand jury. It's going to play out before us, which was different from the Idaho case and most other cases that we see. So he realizes that this is stuff that's going to come out. So that's why he gave us the playbook a little bit early. But the bottom line is, Tony, that's what I think is so unique to what's happening now. Before, in other cases, and I'll keep going back to Timothy McVeigh, because he was another guy that I think is very similar in how he thought. We didn't see it all play out like this because didn't have social media. True. Mainstream media didn't have these connects, and everything was kept, you know, locked behind closed doors in terms of this evidence. Now we get to see it, and everybody's going, wow, really? Things happen like this? They do.
he's, and again, this is a piece of information we have as of right now, and if I'm off on it, let me know. From what we've understood, he's not necessarily cooperating with the FBI as of this moment in time. I found that to be another interesting point, just because it's like he's ready to give it up in with the family. He's admitting he did it to his Discord group. He's admitting he did it to his family. He's admitting it in text. He's admitting it here and there, and now he's not cooperating?
Well, Tony, he probably has an attorney. I think
okay.
He's gotten him attorney, and that was part of, you know, I'm sure the friend who's the minister, who was the former law enforcement officer, I'm sure he said, you got to get him an attorney so his rights are protected, one. And so I think he's just, you know.
Maybe he's just saying, I'm not talking till I get an attorney.
Yeah, and who he shouldn't. He shouldn't be talking.
Sure.
And also, secondarily to that, listen, he is facing the death penalty. And with all the evidence we can see so far, this seems really strong of a
pretty
case.
Pretty much guaranteed at this point, I would say.
Well, the fingerprint on the trigger kills it.
Yeah.
Even if it's your grandparent, and they could say, well, he had it in the house. That's when the trigger. Yeah, okay. Let a jury mull that all over with you add everything else up. It's like the sheath with the Idaho case. All right, you've got all of this and DNA on the sheath, and now you have DNA on the trigger and on the gun. It's so problematic. I think it's a strong case. Only in this case, I just can't imagine that they're going to bargain. I really don't think they're going to bargain way down the road, but we'll see.
What is there to bargain for? I mean, he's admitted it. I mean, well, he's admitted to family. I mean, we don't know, has he admitted it to law? Because there's a difference between I admit this to family or law enforcement. I mean, so where does that stand as of this second?
Well, he's admitted it to family, and they would be calling the father. That remember, the mother was the first to recognize her son, and then went to the father. And then the gun comes out. And they're, can you send me a picture of grandpa's gun so I know you have it? And then, of course, he says, oh, I think I'm going to ignore that one. You're right. It's such a strong case. Look, I think this guy is facing, you know, well, he is going to face death, the death penalty, unless something severely changes in some way, which I can't imagine.
I mean, is this what domestic radicalization looks like now? It's quiet, it's fast, and it is deeply personal. I mean, because that really... If we're trying to figure out what the trigger is here, I mean, it could have simply been Charlie Kirk is coming to town and I disagree with him and I want him dead. Or, I mean, is that it? Just Charlie Kirk showing up, or is there something deeper going on? I mean, obviously, from what we can glean right now, I'm going to assume he probably did not agree with Charlie on most things. And again, that I guess would be going back to the triggering event being Charlie Kirk coming to town. But we don't see a whole lot of other things in his life that are, you know, super triggering. I get his family probably did not agree with his lifestyle in that. But then from that to this, it's like, okay, what the hell's happening here?
Well, the family talks about a discussion they had with their son, where it's brought up that he's going to be in Orem and he's going to be doing his, you know, prove me wrong, you know, debating. And apparently Tyler Robinson reacts to that and says words to the effect of, oh, well, that's a quote unquote stupid place for him to do that. And goes on a diatribe about how he disagrees with Charlie Kirk. And the bottom line is, I think that Charlie Kirk really was more integral and touched a certain, you know, the 20-year-olds, right? I mean, personally, for me, I didn't watch Charlie Kirk, but I remember different TikToks and things like that that would come in my feed that would be snippets of what he said, right? But some of the youth are very well-versed about Kirk. I mean, much more well-known in that age parameter. So I think he very well knew Charlie Kirk and followed him in a negative, visceral way. And he's like, oh, my gosh, he's what, 2.5, 3 hours away? I think I'm going to drive up there.
So, yeah, where I can when you try to put your mind into that gymnastics of someone who would do this, it would be
Yeah, I mean, he could stand for far, far worse than being just something that has a very, very different opinion of you, no matter how different it may be. Some will take that to quite an extreme rather than move on and, okay, you can have a different opinion, then it's okay. We're going to go our different ways. Don't have to be part of each other's lives. Some will want to extinguish the other opinion completely.
I mean, does the FBI have models for identifying these short fuse actors? Because it seems like I think we just lit a tinderbox of a fireworks stand of short fuse actors here that I'm really scared to see what the coming weeks and months have ahead of us.
Well, I think many of us have put forth that the FBI is going to have to completely change its direction, law enforcement as a whole, in terms of evaluating individuals who are saying things online and then appropriately investigating those. This has just all got to change, because if you look at school shooters, mass shooters, assassins, it's not that they don't talk about it. They talk about it. They write about it before it ever happens. Mm-hmm. We need to get better about identifying that. And it's going to have to be done through AI programming, I think.
And there's a big difference, though, between somebody out there saying, I'm going to go shoot somebody, and someone who disagrees with someone for their political beliefs. And I feel like we're entering some pretty scary territory right now, where just those disagreements, not any threat, not any I hate you, not even any I want to hurt you, or just nothing, just simple disagreement right now seems to be on the line of possible chopping block for some. That's a scary place to be in.
Well, I agree. I mean, certainly our constitutional right of free speech has to be protected, but there is a line there. You can't threaten. And if you have somebody saying, I can't wait to murder this guy, I'm going to get a gun.
I agree. All for that. Go after those people. Yeah. That's not protected free speech. I guess what I worry about is just anyone disagreeing on whatever side it may be they disagree with. And then one side having either more power politically or more power in terms of activated people out there. Basically what we're talking about here, these, you know, kind of short fuse actors, if you will then go, oh my gosh, you disagree with me on X issue. We must silence you. But the person it's not doing anything. It's just regular political, you know, debate that we have in our country, which Charlie, you know, is championed, that's, you know, what he would say he would have championed in a lot of parts of his life. That's a scary point. And how is this going to be deciphered of what is dangerous speech and what is not dangerous speech, I guess?
Well, and I know what you're speaking of. And certainly Pam Bondi recently came out and, you know, was talking about hate speech. And there wasn't a lot of defining that, but how I took that is hate speech that leads to a threat. And the threat is where you cross the line.
Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, anybody could say something that they disagree with, and then the more extreme person could go, yeah, I disagree with that, and then it leads someone else to, would this have to be in the same line of the same individual making the threat that makes the hate speech? Because one could say, well, this person disagreed vehemently with it, but they didn't make any threat, they just disagreed, because we're allowed to do that in this country. And then someone else jumps on that is more extreme. I mean, we're walking a very fine line right now.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting. I totally agree with you. Kash Patel said before the hearings that specifically they're looking at more than 20. In fact, he scoffed at the number 20 that were involved in this Discord group that that Tyler Robinson was involved in. He scoffed at it and he said, listen, there's way more than 20 and we're going to be looking at everybody. I guarantee agents are already knocking on the doors of those people that were involved in that Discord, those people that were involved. Were they egging him on? Were they as hard as lover twigs? What all happened to get him, as you said, from point A to point murdering somebody in a week? What all ignited that? Or was it just him? The FBI is going to be getting to the bottom of it. So to your point, that begs the question, does that mean just ideologically, I push you and push you and push you, but I don't make any threats. Can you be charged?
And look, I can understand that area. I think the concern a lot of American citizens have right now more so is just going on Facebook and disagreeing. Disagreeing on either directions in some points where if I say this out loud, what could the consequence be? And we've never been in a place where it's like, oh, this could actually, like, me, not a threat, but just someone disagreeing with a policy, whether this or that could lead to much further action than just somebody, you know, giving you a thumbs down or disagreeing and making a nasty comment to you.
Well, I think the other thing that needs to be considered, I think what you're talking about should not be in jeopardy. But, you know, they just arrested, I think it was a 12 or 13 year old. I think it was 13 who had a bunch of guns, who said he was angry, who wanted to kill. Right. So he's saying all these things.
Good. Arrest him.
And they arrested him. But then they just let him back out, by the way, on bond, which I'm like, oh, my gosh, what are we doing here?
Well, we let rapists and murderers and all that out. And then we prosecute the dads when they rescue their daughters who have been kidnapped. So only in America, as Brooks and Dunn would say. Maybe it's time we do a new version of that song with new lyrics. What do you think?
I think so.
I don't think they would want to sing them. I think that's the problem. So much to talk about. It was so fascinating. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for coming on. And as I've said to Robin, too, just being voices of reason in a very, very confusing time right now, and being able to talk about these things without having politics being involved, but addressing the concerns that so many people have. I think that's very important. So thank you so much for coming on. Break the Case is your podcast. You can check it out anywhere you get podcasts and on YouTube. Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Be sure to check that out. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Well, here we are again, another day in America where after a horrible tragedy, we're here to talk about it. And I don't know why, but this one feels different. We're going to talk about why that is. Of course, we're talking about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, which occurred in Utah at a college campus just yesterday, the 10th. Of September 2025. The tinderbox in America feels like it just kind of blew up. What happens next? Why did this take place? And what does this change as we go forward? Here we are on the 24th anniversary of 9/11. Discussing all of this, and to help us do that, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, Stacey Cole, Todd Michaels, all with us this morning. I'm just going to throw it out there at this. Siobhan, why do you think this one seems to hit different for a lot of Americans?
The sad truth is that I think for a large section of the country, we are already living in a civil war of ideas. Both sides are not shooting at each other yet, but on an emotional level, it's you use the word tinderbox, it's an incredibly intense and fraught time in the country. And I think when people have a political leader that they look up to, that person becomes symbolic for everything that they believe in. Mm-hmm. And so an attack on their leader really hits them hard. It's like the general was killed, you know, and I did not follow Charlie Kirk. I tend to personally stay away from people that would go in the extremist category, no matter what side they're on, sure. Because I like to just get the facts and then come to my own opinions based on that. But a lot of people were very emotionally invested in his message. Mm-hmm. And so an attack on him feels like an attack on them and their values.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's, I can't tell you I've ever listened to a full episode of Charlie Kirk. I knew who he was. I recently listened to a Bill Maher interview with him, which I thought was interesting considering the two are pretty much diametrically opposed on most views. I'm not, you know, I wasn't a Charlie Kirk, you know, fan of his message, but I respected his ability to give his message out there to who he wanted to. That's why we're in America. That's why you're able to do what you're able to do, and why you're able to do what you're able, why you're able to do it. And I think people on the opposite side of this are also very much affected, because this one doesn't, it's as polarizing as a figure as Charlie Kirk could be. At the end of the day, I think a lot of people, both sides of this, are very shaken up. There was another shooting. There was a high school shooting while mm-hmm. this happened.
Yeah.
But his assassination seems to almost symbolically feel very different. I don't know. I'm really kind of at a loss for words on this, because it really shook me. I don't know. It's just, I saw the video and I don't want to ever see that again. But at the end of the day, he was at a college campus debating people. You know, I mean, this is insane that we're at a place where this is what we have to worry about on a campus, on a public setting, a public forum. I mean, should we have already been worrying about this? Should this have never taken place to begin with? Should they have looked at this in another way? Like, maybe the risks here are too great to do something like this. I don't know. There's so many would have, could have, should have in this. But then you have a father of two who was brutally, brutally murdered. And it goes beyond any of his opinions. It was just completely, I feel like there's a destabilization that has taken place. Has it? Are we about to enter a zone in our country now where we're going to start seeing a lot more political type assassinations?
I fear so. I also think it's been progressive. You know, mm-hmm. if we look at the list, a lot of people online have been circulating a list of all the political violence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, from going way back, we'd say in the last decade, there's been an increasing number of people. Just 3 months ago, the Minnesota, you know, Democrat mm-hmm. legislator killed in her home and her husband and her dog. And the guy had a hit list of 45 other Democratic names. Paul Pelosi attacked and mm-hmm. hit the head with a hammer. I mean, this is all stuff. This is not what we're used to in this country. I mean, there have always been the occasional political assassination, but it's been rare. It's not been the norm. And I think we've moved into a time where people are so rigidified and so activated and so angry. And then you throw a little bit of psychopathology in here and somebody that thinks that they're the virtuous savior. And, you know, it's a very fraught time. I personally avoid crowds. You know, there are a lot of parades or events that I would normally like to go to. I just don't feel it safe. And to go to a big political rally outside, I think you're taking your life in your hands at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the climate that we're in, where that is just kind of the harsh reality of it. We react to things in this country when they happen very harsh, and then we have very short memories.
What do we do about it? I mean, at this point, how many school shootings have we had in the last week?
Yeah.
I don't know the number, but I can think of at least three.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. It could be two, but there was one in Minnesota. There's one in Denver. I thought there was another one in between. But, you know, we're outraged for a day and then we go about our business. And when is it going to be enough? Where's the tipping point? Did we just hit it? Did we hit it yesterday? I don't know.
What I'm wondering about this, because I think everyone needs to take in society a big collective breath here on every side. This could be a time, as we're on the 24th anniversary of 9/11, of everybody, like, take politics aside and come together and go, what the hell are we doing? Mm-hmm. Like nobody wanted this to happen. Now, are there assholes out there on each side going and celebrating this death? Yes. And you should probably, you know, go find a hole and jump in if you're doing that. This is nothing to be celebrated. This is nothing. I don't care what you thought of Charlie Kirk. to be vitriolic about or anything of that nature. This is a human being who is expressing their opinion in a country where we are allowed to do it. And we are, we celebrate it as one of our virtues. And yet we're in an atmosphere where the attitude seems to be, let's shut everyone up who has a different opinion than ours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can't be there. That doesn't work in a civilized society. And like you said earlier, this differs because it feels like, and we don't know the motivation behind the killer. And I don't even think it matters, but it mm-hmm. does feel like it's an attack on an idea on what Charlie, what he stood for, what he believed in, which many people believe in. And they're not horrible human beings. They're fellow Americans with different opinions. Mm-hmm. And we've always been in a place where we live with fellow Americans with different opinions. And Charlie Kirk had all the dangers of a 1994 Sunday school teacher. What I found very interesting about all this, everybody that I was talking to yesterday, the comments that I read, I heard so many people say, yeah, but he said this. Yeah, but he said that. And you know what?
He has a right to say those things in this country.
But give me a second. The reality is, when I looked up 90% of the things that people are spewing to each other, going, he said this, he said that, he never said.
Hmm.
There's so many, there's so much of this, let's jump on the bandwagon, and because he represents this or his view is over here and that, somebody's going to say, well, he says this. Well, did you hear he said that? And it's telephone, and it goes, and it goes. Did anyone mm-hmm. ever hear him say half of these things? And you look it up, it's like he's never actually said this.
That's that. A really good point.
Now yeah. there's plenty of shit. You know, I'm sure he said every side has their shit that they say. And some can view this as dangerous or that as dangerous. But I found it very interesting that most of the big points that I saw people throwing around there online of, well, he said this, never fucking happened. Mm. Never said aloud. But people would assign those things to him, and then they believed it. Mm-hmm. And then they sat behind it. And then they repeated it over and over. And then people grew more hate for somebody based on things that aren't even real. And I'm not trying to stick up for the views of Charlie Kirk. I'm trying to be a voice of reason here of people. They don't vet anything and they don't mm-hmm. care about facts. They mm-hmm. want to go with a narrative that makes them feel good and makes them feel mm-hmm. most grounded in whatever they feel safe with, whether it's real or not. Can you speak to that at all on why, yeah. why this is happening?
100%. It's an area of absolute fascination to me. You know, culture traditionally involved the people around us, right? And culture teaches us what reality is, who our people are, who our enemies are, and who deserves to be killed, right? Mm-hmm. And culture has moved online. And that has changed everything. Because what gets clicks online, what gets attention, what causes people to tune in to the stations that they choose to watch? It's emotion. It's amygdala reaction. And the amygdala is that emotional center of the brain where we get fight, flight, freeze. And outrage keeps people watching. It keeps people tuned in. It keeps people frightened and angry. And since culture has moved online, we've seen this increase in polarization and extremism. And people have started to become so enraged, they become addicted to the rage. And when you're that angry, you can justify all sorts of horrible behavior. And so I think that's been the big shift with extremism. I talk about that quite a bit in my book, The Minds of Mass Killers. I have a whole chapter on extremism and the psychology of that. And this really, I think, because how do we make good decisions? How do we analyze information? How do we assess what's true and what isn't? That's the prefrontal cortex. That's the thinking part of the brain, not the emotional center of the brain. But not everybody takes a pause when they hear something outrageous. And do they stop and think, I need to process this a little bit before I completely swallow it? And so I think this is why we see the most extremely upsetting things shared on social media, because it's incentivized to keep people agitated. I stopped listening to some of the network news in 2016. I would listen, you know, through podcasts because I don't have an actual TV, so I don't have cable, but I would listen to some of the news shows. And it hit me one day, my anxiety would go through the roof. My anger would go through the roof the more I listened. And one of the stations was actually playing with all their intro music. It was battle music. Mm-hmm. It was like war music.
Yeah.
And I just listened to this music and I said, this is putting me in my amygdala. Mm-hmm. You know, I do want to be aware, but I want to go for things that are more fact-based and not keeping me agitated. And then I can process and think it through more logically. But humans aren't very good at using their prefrontal cortex, and it's easily exploited. And I think this is part of the culture wars that we're seeing, the chaos that we're seeing that plays out from school districts to local governments to, you know, the kinds of political violence that we're seeing, and now assassinations. And it's a big thing. And when we look at it in the big picture, it's like, how do we dial this back a bit? I think when we have politicians who emphasize, we are one country. We are one people. We may have differences of opinion, but let's talk that through and let's use collaborative problem solving, right? This is how we teach preschoolers.
Yeah, right. I was just going to say we do that in families.
Yeah, use your words. Don't hit each other. You know, calm down, take a time out. All these skills. I've said we need preschool teachers running the country because they might do a better job than a lot of our political leaders.
You know, I feel like people are in a constant state of fight or flight right now. And it's been that way for many years, that one little thing is going to set somebody off. If you say something, if you reference something, people are immediately set off instead of, hey, that's an interesting point. Let me think more about that.
Right.
No, it's just F you, you know, and screw you. I'm blocking you. I'm doing all of this. And I've been guilty of that myself. It's the climate we're in. And it's interesting that you talked about the music that a lot of the news stations play. It gets you feeling on edge. It makes you feel like I need to know what's going on because something bad is happening.
Exactly.
When in fact, there's not. They'll throw you the breaking news alert. And it's something that happened 2 days ago. It's not breaking news.
Yeah.
Our breaking news threshold has changed.
I don't think breaking news means, I think 9/11 changed that, because everything became breaking news after 9/11. It was like a cat stuck in a tree, you know, breaking news.
But it keeps us on edge and it keeps us perched waiting to hear that next big thing. And our bodies can't sustain that. Right. Your cortisol levels are through the roof. Everybody is just so on edge that if you're ready to crack, you're this close to doing it.
100%. You nailed it. That's absolutely exactly what happens. Everybody's on edge. Mm-hmm. And some people never calm down. I spend a lot of my workday now with people who just are agitated about politics, and they want to use their whole hour just to vent. And they're outraged and they're terrified. And so my approach with everybody, take a breath. We've got to get your nervous system calm here, and let's move to problem solving and dosing, how much you expose yourself to all this, because there are legitimate things to be concerned about. Mm-hmm. But when you're so upset, you're not able to do any good in the world, and don't let this stuff ruin your life. But everybody's needing to hear that right now.
Yeah. I feel like we've become a nation of abused pets. You know, like if you've ever had an abused dog or cat, and anytime you walk into the room, and even no matter how much love you show it, and it's still going on. Like I feel like that's where we're at. We're in this place where we have to constantly keep looking around, because what's the next thing that we're going to hear?
Yeah.
And so many of these things that we hear shock us and they scare us. But at the end of the day, in our own lives, in our own homes, how much of it actually affects us? Like if you turned the television off and you didn't consume all of this, and 2 weeks later you turned it back on, I'm curious, like how you would feel in those 2 weeks of not consuming anything. And did any of it affect you? did the outside world, the tree falling in the forest, I'm sure it made a noise. It didn't hit your house. It didn't affect you directly. And it's not to say don't have empathy for people that other decisions are affecting. But at the end of the day, we also can't be the saviors of everything to everybody. We have to help those in our immediate control and in our immediate path. If we all could focus on that a little bit more instead of being the social justice warriors for the planet or for large swaths of things that we have absolutely no control over, right, we might be a little healthier. You know, I said a lot of this with the political climate and things like that as they were happening. I think I even said it to you, Stacey, at the when all this, I said, look, if you didn't watch anything for the next 4 years, I bet you'd be a lot happier person. And at the end of those 4 years, would you have rather spent 4 years worrying uncontrollably about things that you have zero control over? Or would you rather have spent those 4 years just enjoying life, doing what you love to do and further pursuing your interests and passions and helping people and all of that? And I think if we can take a collective breath at that, I think we'd be a bit of a happier society if we could hone ourselves in a little bit more for the reality of reality's terms that we all live with around us.
Beautifully said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To that point, you know, my life situation changed dramatically about 2 months ago, and I'm living in a different situation. I have two TVs in my apartment. I used to live in a home. Not like a institutionalized home, but a house. And everybody's like, yeah, we know. But I don't have the TV on. I spend a lot of time here at my desk. I'm usually out of my apartment doing some other things. And I haven't watched TV in probably, gosh, I want to say 4 weeks. Like, I have not sat down and turned on the TV. I haven't watched any news. I do once in a great while look at the Associated Press, you know, top headlines, that kind of thing. I've turned off all of my news alerts. And I go to bed with Schitt's Creek playing in the background. And I set my timer for 30 minutes. And that's what I fall asleep to every night. And my level of anxiety has absolutely dropped. It probably for other reasons as well. But I don't wake up anxious. I don't feel like, oh God, what did I miss? What did I miss? Mm-hmm. You know what? The sun came out. The birds are chirping. I'm good. Yeah. That's what I can control. My cats are here. We're good.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you have to look at what's in your bubble and check your bubble, because we can't do anything about what's going on in the greater world. We can't fix it.
And like I said, I think we need if we want to live in this society, everybody is entitled to have their opinions. And mm-hmm. and honest to God, there's far more extreme people than Charlie Kirk. Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, he was one of the few who wanted to have conversations. That was the point of what he was actually doing. Now, you can disagree with his views, but his point, he wasn't there with a big sign that said, fuck you, I'm right. It was prove me wrong. Let's have a conversation. Let's have a dialogue. And he used verbiage of like, okay, prove me wrong. Let's talk. It's the old adage of the person in the park with a sign. It's exactly what he was doing, literally in a park with a sign doing this. Right. And he encouraged and he could talk competently. I mean, if you go back and if you don't know anything about Charlie Kirk, and I didn't know a lot about Charlie Kirk, go watch the Bill Maher interview. I mean, if you don't agree with him on much of anything, which I personally don't, but I don't hate the man, and nor should he have died. This is utterly insane. We could disagree, but I felt like at the end of the day, I could probably go have a beer with the guy and we could have a conversation like we used to do. And we could hear each other and go, oh, okay, well, this is how you believe things. This is how you were brought up. This is okay. I can respect that. He wasn't like, and my belief system, I'm going to go in and I'm going to take this away from you. It's like, we can exist. We can coexist is essentially, I think, was part of his message, as much as people want to say it wasn't. He wasn't a let's kill everyone that disagrees with us type person. It's sad and it's shocking, because this is something where I feel like both sides are digging in even deeper to things that are not real. where you see one side going, well, every Democrat hates him and this is horrible. They're all celebrating. Yeah. You're like, no,
yeah.
I didn't see. I mean, maybe I'm sure if I dug deeper, I could find some real horrible assholes who were celebrating.
Sure.
Not much.
But you know
not
what? Much. For the most part, nobody was.
Yeah.
For the most part, anybody I knew who was a respectable Democrat were heartbroken. We're like, mm-hmm. holy shit, this is not good. This is horrible. Mm-hmm. So reality check for everybody on this. Most sane, healthy thinking people, nobody is celebrating this shit. No. They are not. You can find an extremist somewhere. Yes. And on the same token, he said this, he said that. Take a look and see if it's actually what he said, or if it's just what Matilde you saw tweeted, who heard it from her cousin, who heard it from that and this, and her, you know, third cousin's cat told them in a dream. Mm-hmm. And now it's on a tweet and must be true because I saw it. And all my girlfriends or all my friends said that that's what he said. Mm-hmm. There was so much of it that it's not even real. But that we base our rage on. We have this rage that we have that's based on fear and not reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we live in a country where you can hate somebody. You can disagree with people. You can be wildly obsessed with hating somebody because of something they said. But that doesn't mean that person needs to die. They deserve to live just like you do.
And maybe you shouldn't be wildly obsessed with hating somebody.
Correct. Period. But in this country, you are afforded that opportunity to be as wacky as possible as long as you're not hurting anybody. If you want to decorate your entire space in whatever fashion you want, that is all one side. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to have, you know, a Trump-themed apartment or a Biden Harris themed apartment, you can do that. Mm-hmm. That's what this country is about, is you get to be you. You get to do whatever you want to do as long as you're not harming anybody. Mm-hmm. And somebody crossed the line hardcore yesterday. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're about. He has the right to say anything he wants to say without being killed.
Mm-hmm.
We crossed that line hard yesterday. It's not okay.
And this is not the first time America has dealt with political violence. Obviously, we've seen a good share of it in recent years. We've been in far worse times before most of us were around or were very, very young. And it's a time that I feel like we're approaching again. I feel like the cycle is turning and we're going back into more extreme and more vitriol on each side. The thing that I found interesting, we're talking to Robin Dreek yesterday, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Siobhan, with the Minds of Mass Killers in your book. He had a stat, 9% of assassination type characters as of this recording, we don't know who did this. They're still searching. 9% historically actually had a motive that was aligned or opposed what the individual they were assassinating had. 9%. The other 91% crazy shit. It was, you know, like John Hinckley. Look at all of the 91% of assassins, their motive has nothing to do with what the person they're killing. So there's a 91% chance that the assassination, the person who assassinated Charlie Kirk gave a damn about, or did not give a damn about what he stood for.
It's a really good point. Yeah, it's a really good point. I hadn't seen that stat, but it doesn't surprise me because really people who assassinate other people, they're coming from a place of distorted thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And are they psychotic? Usually not psychotic, although John Hinckley definitely was. Mm-hmm. But they tend to be people who are angry. They've got some mild to severe paranoid ideation going, where they have this sense of somebody out there is doing things to them, so I'm so angry about it, I'm going to pick a target. And some of them, it didn't matter, the one that shot at Trump, mm-hmm. he had also looked at shooting Biden, right? Yep. So it's this sense of, I want to be important, I want to make a statement, I'm angry, and I want to send a message about, you know, who knows what, because they've all got it to some extent, a different motive, but they're vengeful and they're unhappy, angry people who are just in many cases looking for fame. Mm-hmm. They idolize other people who have committed similar crimes before them. And so there's really this distorted thinking process and this desire to be important.
Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting in the translation of all of it, and you can insert this into any scenario. I'm just going to use the Trump one, not for any political reason, but the shooter there, again, he just wanted to shoot somebody is the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But the translation, and this is, I feel like so much of just gets lost in translation is, see, they're out to get us. Mm-hmm. Meaning in this case, I've seen so many folks, Trump supporters, see, they hate us. They're trying to get us.
Yeah.
Who's they?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who like we're talking about this one guy. Like,
exactly.
And it can go the other way too. And I've seen it the exact opposite too. See, the Republicans hate the Democrats. See, the Democrats hate the Republicans, or this supporter hates that. And it goes to such extreme. They want us dead. They want, like, no, I don't think most rational human beings do. But yeah, when we get into our groups, into our tribes, and we start telling each other they want you dead, and the other side's like, no, I don't. I actually, I'd like to go out for dinner tonight and have a conversation.
Right.
I don't know why you think I want you dead. Like, right, we disagree, but we keep telling ourselves these things. And then we get more and more distant from people that don't have the exact same viewpoint that we do. And it gets to the point where when you do see them, it gets more and more distant and more off. And then, well, you know, they're my family's like this. I don't want to do this. And then eventually you're just not there anymore.
There he goes.
Yeah. Having part of the conversation.
Yep.
And you're over in your corner freaking out because the cacophony of voices that are telling you what to believe, you are just consuming it, going, well, these people, they agree with me. They're telling me this is so dangerous and so scary, and all these people, they feel this way and they hate me this much. And then you realize, if you were to come back to that table, no, they actually just want you to pass the fucking gravy.
Yeah. 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 You hit on something that I think is critically important. Humans are wired neurobiologically. We come into the world with a natural tendency to separate ourselves into categories and tribes. And I call it the us them process. Mm-hmm. I'm not the originator of that term. We'll credit neuroscientist Robert Sapolsky of Stanford, who I think is the most brilliant person in the world in talking about human behavior. But we're all wired into categorized people. And even with infants, if they are raised in one racial group, you know, their caregivers are of the same race, when an infant sees a face of a person of another race, they have an anxiety reaction. Mm-hmm. So we're all just wired biologically to like the people like us and feel very suspicious or dislike the people that are not like us. And this can be racial, it can be ethnic, it can be economic class. But it ends up with this distorted thinking that we're good to the people like us, but the people that are not like us are the thems, and it's okay to treat them badly. And actually, some of the most fascinating research is that when you get really polarized into this us-them thinking, which the media has helped us do, mm-hmm, for their own purposes, we actually, as humans, not meaning me personally, I try to avoid this, but we as humans get more of a dopamine rush from seeing the thems punished than we do from seeing our side succeed, which is pretty twisted. And I think that's what we're seeing play out. People are so fired up and so amygdala driven and so non-thinking right now that they would rather see something bad happen to the other side than see everything get better for everybody. Because in truth, the only us them we should be doing is, we're all Americans. We're all us. We may have our slight differences, but it's not, we're running the country like it's a team sport, bloodthirsty team sport. And we want our team to win, and we get great joy when the other team loses. So it's pretty twisted.
Is there a biological drive? I mean, you touched on it a little bit, but you know, we'd like to think that we are evolved as a species, but I wonder if this doesn't go back to us just being primates, that we 100%. Are driven to be in these tribes, and this is our way of hunting and gathering.
Yes.
Instead of going, you know, into the cave at night, we go back to our homes, that we are just really not as evolved as we'd like to think.
Not at all.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So true. I have one guru in life, and it's Robert Sapolsky, a neuroscientist of Stanford University. He is a brilliant man. He's written so much. My favorite book of his came out in 2017, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Our Worst. And he really in-depth explores the ways that we are pretty darn primitive. And we like to think that we're these cognitive, logical creatures. And in truth, we're very emotionally driven. And then we come along later and make up these cognitive reasons for why we're right. But we're coming from this place of very primitive emotions. And he also is a specialist in primatology, you know, so he studies primates. And we are, as I like to say, we're just monkeys that got a little too smart and learned how to destroy the world and create massive war. And and there's a lot about us that we're not all we like to think we are.
Mm-hmm. We seem to be very much in a world of, or we like to jump to absolutes, where everything is in reality very much in the middle. And there's a lot of gray, and most things fall into the gray. But why is it that we are in such a world? I mean, have we always been here, and we are just communicating far more, and we're hearing everybody's absolutes in our ears 1,000 times more than we ever did in the past? Because that seems to be a big thing of this, of it's this way or that way, period. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in the middle. And this person, you know, because they looked at you this way one day, or you're making an assumption about them because they were at this event or had this tweet or liked this or whatever, then they must be all of that.
Right.
Because of this, it must be all of that. And that's not usually reality.
No. I always say middle ground is where you find the truth. Mm-hmm. And the farther you get out to this extreme type of thinking, you're getting distortion, and no good comes of that. So I'm always encouraging people to pause, to ponder, to use that good thinking brain. And if we're ever going to see a shift with this polarization, we've got to gain some skills in doing that and calm down this rage response. But it really does get addicting. People get a high out of being angry. And we can all think of the news channels that feed that want to keep people angry. And I think the media has a lot to do with it, along with, you know, social media. I follow a lot of social media just to kind of monitor what are the trends and what's influencing people. And I can always pick out the thoughtful ones, you know, on my friends list, people who are going to, and that's not the majority. The people who get very polarized into the us, them, we've got to punish the thems. That's worse than I've ever seen it.
What does history show us on something like this, or research about the time window when copycat attacks are most likely to happen after something like this, where it's a politically motivated thing? And this is, you know, he was a very big figure in this, in that world. What do you think history has shown us of other times where we've seen a very hot tinderboxes like we're seeing now?
It's really common 2 to 3 weeks, whether it's any kind of mass killing, school shooting, anything like that, that there's a risk factor for copycats. But I think in this climate, every one that happens that gets attention for the perpetrator, they start to feel like, look, I can be famous. They study all the other people and that have done it. And this is another online thing that they tend to get into. They almost gamify it. You know, they want to top each other. And I think in the coming years, I think it's going to be a very fraught time. I would expect, I mean, really, when we look at the number of polarized, angry people out there who are heavily armed, more guns than people in this country. Mm-hmm. Anybody can get a gun if they're so motivated. We're not doing a good job with trying to rein that in any way. In fact, it seems to get worse every time. I think we're going to see an increase that could probably go on for several years.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously they perceive this as a safe space to have this sort of discourse. And I was kind of talking about this a little bit earlier. Was that, and I'm not, you know, not vilifying anybody who said, let's have this out there at this setting. I mean, in a perfect world, you'd think you could, but we have seen violence like this many a time. Somebody in a tall building shooting down at people. I mean, look at the Las Vegas shooting all those years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that every time I go to an event that has tall buildings around it. I'm going to one tonight, and every time I'm at this venue, I'm always like, there's a lot of tall buildings here. I wonder if anybody's checking those. And I'm guessing the answer is probably no. It's like, it'll be fine. And it's like, well, then something happens, and then like, well, what we should do that again. But that's how we forget, where it's like horrible, horrible things happen. It takes just a little extra time to maybe do this or that, or just don't have things in spaces that are going to be presenting as an opportunity for really horrible people. It sucks that we're in a place where we got to do that. But I feel like maybe we're going to need to do a bit more of that. I mean, how does the erosion of perceived safe spaces, I mean, feed into the collective anxiety and polarization that we're seeing?
It's huge. It's huge. And it definitely affects the places I go. When I do go to a place, a concert or something, where I like to go, where they check people for weapons before you go in, which at least here in Portland, most concerts, you got to open your bag and go through metal detectors. Yep. And I'm grateful that they do that. But if I were going to go to an event, particularly an outdoor event where people aren't screened and there's no checkpoints going on, I just skip it at this point, which is terrible that we have to rein in activities and normal social behavior, things we'd like to do, just because there are fears of safety. A lot of people driving vehicles into crowds. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, we always think guns, and usually it's guns, but it can be vehicle, you know, attacks.
Happened in Wisconsin at that Christmas parade. It was shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, and the answer, I mean, it's not really a solution. It seems like a big band-aid of like, well, let's, you know, basically fortify everything. And we can to a certain extent, you know, until you can't. And I mean, ultimately, this is a mental health crisis that we have people that can go to such extreme beliefs and feel like this is the best way to handle things.
But we're stoking people every single day. Yeah. And we're just stoking these fears that started and pouring gasoline on these fires. And we're doing nothing to put the fires out. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that freaks me out, is it's escalating every single day.
And the thing is, and people like to blame the media is doing it. Like, you know who the fucking media is these days? It's each other. Mm-hmm. It's looking at your TikTok. It's looking at your Facebook page. It's not going and watching ABC News, World News Tonight. It's every person that's around you that's saying something, probably not super vetting much of what they're saying, and you believing it. Mm-hmm. So our media has become each other, very uninformed each other.
And that's a dangerous media.
In our bubbles. And you know, the media, they used to vet things a little bit. I mean, there is still vetting that goes on in media, believe it or not. And I know, like, there's certain places that are certainly slanted this way and that, without a doubt. But it's like, let's find the villain here. It's the media. No, it's each other. It, at the end of the day, it is each other. It is not the media. It's each other, because each other is the media. Social media, the social, that's us. That's all of us collectively. Not us with a podcast, but like everybody.
Yeah, I think the idea of everybody taking personal responsibility for being part of a solution rather than feeding the problem and trying to be collaborative, because bottom line, the government should be about solving problems for the populace, making the country work well, making sure that people's needs are met. My gosh, can we do something about the healthcare crisis? You know, can we do something about violent crime, about the mental illness on the streets, you know, among the street people? That's where we should be focusing from a problem-solving perspective. That's the point of government, and we just don't see much of that happening.
Naturally, when anything like this occurs, you're going to start hearing it, and we're already starting to hear it. The word conspiracy.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not jumping on the bandwagon of this, but we're already starting to see that. Let's talk a little bit about that in a 10,000 foot overview when it comes to, you know, major events like this that seem to change history in some way, shape, or form. Why do we go down the road of conspiracy? Is it because sometimes that turns out to be right, or lack of information, or we don't know what's right? I mean, there's still many conspiracies of things from, you know, JFK. You know, there's, you know, still it's one person believes this, one person believes that. Where do we go in a society with conspiracy on a topic like this? Because I look at some and it's not hard to go, well, I mean, that could kind of make some sense over here, depending on what that specific conspiracy is. But we're very quick to jump to that, it seems.
Yeah. People love conspiracies because it gives them a reason for things. And I think it's another thing about our brain. We don't like ambiguity. We don't like understanding things. It feels scary. And so when you can come up with a theory, even a weird theory, but this is what's going on. This is what happened. I understand it now. I've got this special knowledge. I can make sense of it. People get a sense of satisfaction out of that. I think that's at least one element.
Satisfaction, and I'm going to also say control, too. Because when you feel powerless and you don't know what's going on. Is it an escape from that's the thing with conspiracy theories. Sometimes it's an escapism to a certain extent, if it's not real. But sometimes the conspiracy, the idea of the conspiracy being carried out to the level of to which a conspiracy would need to be carried out is far scarier than the actual act of took place in many situations.
And I think the other element of that is people enjoy on some perverse level. I mean, why do people still believe that Bigfoot exists and that they're in danger of Bigfoot when they go out on a camping trip? I mean, people sort of like being scared sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sense of pleasure in that. Look at this terrible thing that's going on and we're all in danger from it. And whether it's aliens coming to, you know, all the great stories about alien conspiracies and all of that, there are still people very invested in that. And conspiracies, yes, it gives people a sense of control. It gives them a sense of excitement. And then sometimes the sense of a little self-esteem boost of, I know the truth and everybody else doesn't, but I've got it. And so I'm special.
Do we just need hobbies? Do we need something else to focus on instead of focusing on, you know, all of these weird tribes that we've all gotten to be part of?
Oh,
do we need to go join a biking group? Do we need
Yes.
do we need to do?
Hell yes. Take jujitsu. Take jujitsu. Take belly dance. Get out in your garden.
I've been doing the belly dancing a lot.
I am doing the jujitsu.
I'm going to perform for everyone right now.
Oh,
I
think we all
do it. Tony, I'll go get some dollar bills.
I'm doing belly dancing, but I want to move to jujitsu with Stacy. I think that would be very good therapy.
Hey, but let me tell you, you can meet some hot guys there too.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I think I talk a lot with people about having a balanced life, and a balanced life incorporates physical activity. It incorporates taking care of your health, getting your medical problems resolved, taking care of your teeth, you know, all these self-care things. And that takes a lot of time. The older we get, you know, just staying alive and healthy takes time. And people neglect that. They go downhill. Their thyroid level, we've been talking about thyroid this week, their thyroid levels can get off and they don't feel their best. And then social activities, we need to be with people who make us laugh.
Yeah.
We need to find joy. And if we're not, we need to have love in our lives. If it's the love of our pets, you know, volunteering is so good for people. Not that we all, if we're working full time, we don't have a lot of time to volunteer, but something where you're doing something altruistic out in the world. And when you've got all these different activities that are healthy, that are positive, that are supporting your life, you feel better, you do better, you're thinking clearly. And then if you want to make a difference in the world and the political system in some way, you're in a much better headspace for doing it in a healthy, collaborative, problem-solving way and getting out of that amygdala rage reaction.
I think there's a lot of, I wouldn't say almost like a feeling of hopelessness. A lot of people share in things like this and events when this, things like this happen. And I would say for me, I mean, I do kind of feel that in some ways, because I think at the end of the day, the folks that maybe we used to look to de-escalate this stuff or be the grown-up in the room and try and collectively, you know, bring us together, it doesn't exist anymore. I mean, the first thing we saw on so many things yesterday was more hate. Was and it's like, where did the grown-ups in the room go? Why are we the people who used to be there? You know, I'm talking about political figures and such that, yeah. You know, no matter what side you're on of this, and I'll tell you what, I saw far more people that would have, you know, theoretically, you know, or agreed with Charlie Kirk's beliefs that were jumping on and saying really horrible shit again mm-hmm. yesterday. It more than you would, you know, the opposite direction, mm-hmm. which, but everybody was screaming, the other side is saying this when this side is saying this. And it's like, can we just stop? Can we just stop saying horrible shit to each other? And can we de-escalate? And that's where the hopelessness comes in, because it's this, you look to for some sort of light and it's just clash. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's gone, that safety net, that grown up in the room. Nobody's mm-hmm. the grown up in the room anymore. Mm-hmm. We're all just sitting here ready to scream at each other. Mm-hmm. And when that's the answer and the calming voices of reason seem to no longer exist in the places of power where they should, mm-hmm. It's a real scary place. And it does mm-hmm. feel kind of hopeless when things like this happen.
It's really hard for people. People are all struggling with that. I struggle with that. You know, at what point do I go to acceptance and seeing that in my lifetime, I maybe never will see the country that I envision, that I want. And that's a sad thing. So I think there's a lot of grief going on for people, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. And when I go to medical appointments now, and, you know, it's a dentist recently who wanted to know what I do for a living. I said, oh, I'm a therapist. And as he had his hands in my mouth, he was venting about politics and asking me questions. Why is this happening? What do we do? And I'm like,
no, it's a great time for conversation, isn't it?
I know. I'm like, I really want to answer your questions, but you got your hands in my mouth right now working on that crown. Yeah. And so it's leaking out everywhere, the hopelessness, the frustration, the anger. And I think if when we get to vote again, if we have another election, that's what we all really need to look for in politicians, who can turn the heat down and who can embrace everybody in the country and see that we are one people, that we've got social problems in this nation, and the role of the government is to help problem solve. You know, mm-hmm. let's focus on healthcare in a productive way, not in a battle, not in an us versus them, but realistically, folks, can we come together and think like adults and serve the country, serve the people that we work for? And that includes all the people, not just our team.
Yeah.
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 And that's the reality. That I wish we could come to in a situation like this.
Siobhan, is that your cat?
You hear her, okay. Yes.
Okay, go. Yes. I just want to make sure, because I keep looking over going, that doesn't sound like my boy, but gosh, maybe it could be. Okay.
Yeah, she's trying to get in the door.
Obviously, someone who's going to go out and do something like this, their problem solving skills aren't the greatest. No. I would say that problem solving skills, again, our way of thinking in absolutes, our problem solving skills, they're not good. What is the answer, Siobhan? How do we have everybody get better problem solving skills so we don't have all of this going on? Is it, and maybe it's more trying to identify what our problems are.
Yeah.
And identifying what are our real immediate problems directly in front of us that we can control and that we can, you know, be a part of. I mean, it kind of goes back to like the serenity prayer to a certain extent, of, you know, just, you know, having the knowledge to be in control, what we can control. Is it we're trying to control too much in our brains, and we're getting too much things being shot at us every which way, shape, and form? Pardon the pun, I didn't mean to say that, the word shot, but is it there's just too much coming at us in too many directions, that we're overwhelmed, and that's why so many folks don't have good problem solving skills.
Yeah, I think doing exactly what we're trying to do today, which is encouraging people to pause, take a breath, think, look at the media they're consuming, analyze, how is this really affecting my mood? Is this helping anything? Or am I just becoming part of the problem, part of that us-them battle? And I think that I try to work on teaching people about their brain, using their thinking brain. You know, I feel like I'm playing preschool a lot of the time, preschool teacher, with just trying to explain things to people. And when I see people really agitated, you know, writing in some fashion, if it's on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it's like, you know, let's try to get out of that us, them. We're mm-hmm. all Americans. We're all in this together, and we're not enemies. We don't have to look at it that way. And so that's one of my goals. One of the reasons I do social media, yes, I like to keep people laughing with strange humor and memes, because I think laughter helps de-escalate that mm-hmm. anger. So there really is a strategy behind that. But also just trying to educate people that when you are living in a rage state, you're addicted to rage, and this is hurting you, and it's not helping the country in any way. So just trying to put that message out there.
Yeah. There was a press conference this morning. We're going to go to that here in just a second. Siobhan, thank you so much for coming out and being another voice of reason while we're having another crisis in our country. You know, that doesn't need to have happened here on another 9/11 24th anniversary. Thank you again so much. Of course, her book, if you want to read it, The Minds of Mass Killers, very fascinating read. Check it out wherever you get books. Siobhan, thank you very much.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.